Well, hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. The Savvy Painter Podcast is published every other week on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, iHeartRadio, and Google Play. If you are a painter who is looking for down-to-earth, real-life conversations about art, how to create it, and how to sell it, you are in the right place. Savvy Painter has been downloaded over 1.5 million times by artists in 150 countries. This is the place where you will find your community. You'll be inspired to create, and you'll hear real stories from artists who are thriving with their art. So if you are new to this podcast, I want to welcome you to the Savvy Painter community. But make sure that you don't miss an episode. Sign up for weekly updates, free guides, and workshop announcements. Just go to savvypainter.com/subscribe. It's that easy. Aubrey Leventhal is my guest today. Aubrey Leventhal is a still life and figurative painter living and working in Philadelphia. She's represented by Nancy Margolis Gallery in New York. In this episode, Aubrey and I talk about her early exposure to art, how her mother made sure she saw the work of women artists so that she had role models as proof that being an artist is possible. We also talk about how to find your voice. Aubrey suggests having specific intentions and cutting out what does not apply to you. For her, discovering who you are as an artist is an ongoing process, and it's as much about simplification, removing what doesn't resonate with you, as anything else. And she shares her advice for artists who struggle with this, how she uses trial and error to paint her way through challenges. Aubrey is consistently trying things out and experimenting to find the outer boundaries of the kind of work she wants to make. Giving yourself the time and space to discover what delights you is key. And for that reason, learning to pace yourself, honor your need for rest, and find ways to replenish your creativity is super important. We also talk about Aubrey's process, how she uses her sketchbook to work out her paintings, whether it's a word that sparks an idea or notes about color. She gives herself just enough to trigger her memory so that she can play with her concepts. So without further ado, here is Aubrey Leventhal. Aubrey, welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you give me a little bit of background on yourself? When did you first decide that you wanted to devote yourself to art?
Sure. I think probably as a lot of other painters experience, there's always this sort of pull. There's never maybe this one defining decision, but I've always had that sort of gravitational pull towards art. But the earliest evidence I've found is this little drawing on paper that I actually have framed in my house now. It's got to be from when I'm about 5 or 6, and it depicts me standing at an easel with a big paintbrush and a big hat on, and and in the painting, like on the easel, is a picture of me. And then underneath it, in like sort of teacher bubbly handwriting, it says, you know, my magic hat would let me be an artist. And I think that's kind of funny, like of all the leeway you have at that age, what your magic hat could let you do. I was already being pulled toward that.
That's a great story. I love it. I can just picture it too. It's so cute.
Yeah, there's always been some kind of, you know, if I could choose anything, there's this sort of pull of this, you know, orbit of painting and drawing around me.
Mm. Who were some of the artists that you looked at when you were younger that inspired you?
You know, I don't remember having, again, like one sort of thing, one person that anchored me in that way, but there were a lot of books around. My mom had always shown me the few women artists that were like super, you know, known, like Georgia O'Keeffe and Mary Cassatt. So I always did like book reports on them. But I don't know. I think I grew up in a way that was really not, maybe at the time I didn't realize, but it wasn't so common, that it sort of felt like it was a possibility to be an artist like any other profession. And I think for me, that had a lot to do with, I guess, my parents, like where they were both coming from. So my dad, right after coming right out of school, he had to go work in the family business, which was Leventhal's Handbags in Center City, Philadelphia, this kind of like iconic discount handbag shop. And he worked there for 40 years. And I think that made him want me to do what I loved because he didn't have the choice. On the other hand, my mom was, she actually grew up on a dairy farm in rural Pennsylvania, and she went to art school up there. And so she had this love of nature, and she showed me those books. And I don't know, the combination of those things, I think, sort of set me on a track that it was sort of plausible to be a painter.
That's a huge gift. You're right, because I think you're right. Not a lot of people get that. And I think it changes everything when you just, from the get-go, believe that this is a possibility and I can do this.
Yeah, I had a lot of students who, you know, would say like, oh, my parents don't want me to do this. And while mine had that concern for how to do it, they always thought, you know, you got to work hard.
Can you talk about your education? What I always like to hear, what was your expectation going into school versus what actually happened?
Sure. So at the undergraduate level, I went to Penn State. And that was a choice. I went in knowing I was an art major, but that was a choice that had a lot to do with, you know, financially, it made a lot of sense. And I wanted to be in a big school. I wanted to be in a good art program within a big university. I didn't have a ton of expectation, I guess, at that point. But I was pretty surprised. Like, I thought I would be getting a lot of traditional, because the experience I'd had up to that point in formal art classes had just been sort of in my high school and like some extracurricular stuff. So I had thought I would have a much more sort of conservative, traditional, like learning about rendering. And it opened up really quickly to ideas of concept and contemporary ideas. And so things were blown really wide open. And that was good in the long run, but it made it really hard at that point to be making work that I felt like I grasped or I felt good about. Yeah. And then I went to PAFA for graduate school, which was a very different experience. That is known to be a school where they, you know, teach you all of this traditional sort of rendering at the undergraduate level. But at the MFA level, it's sort of a mixture of different approaches. Each sort of critic has a real, you know, their own way of working, their ideas, their corner. And that was really good for me to be in a place where I saw modeled the intensity of, you know, creating your own way of working and process.
Do you remember when you came to the realization that that idea that in the long run, the conceptual piece of it was better for you, even though you struggled through not knowing, it sounded like, correct me if I'm wrong, not knowing the technical skills of how to draw maybe or color or those foundational skills as well as you might have wanted to?
Mm-hmm. I think it just opened up this idea of play to me that you could make work that was just back to what got me interested in always wanting to make work in the first place, which was experimenting and, you know, seeing what your boundaries were, I guess. So it made it hard because when you haven't made a lot of work to feel like, oh, this is what I do. And that's a real struggle when you're trying to figure that out. But I think looking back now, if I hadn't had that struggle to figure out what my work was about, to see how many sort of roads there were, I don't think my work would have developed as much. So I don't know exactly when. I would say probably at some point, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years after the experience, I look back and thought like, oh, I know, now I understand what they were trying to teach me there. Because I also got into this thing where I had an internship at the Institute of Contemporary Art here in Philly, which is a very sort of cutting edge contemporary space. And so once I learned about that, I thought like, oh, well, everything has to be this way, you know, conceptual. So I circled back around from that sort of way of looking and came back to painting. I mean, I was always painting, but came back to some of the ideas that I had earlier about painting.
This is a question I get from a lot of artists, this concept or this idea of finding your own voice. Do you feel like you've found your voice?
It seems to be a thing that is constantly being, things start to edit down. So it's not maybe that it's like one moment you don't have your voice and the next you do, but it starts to get a little bit more specific for me. So I feel like I know where my work is, but it may continue to sort of change and also get more and more specific, I would hope, as I continue to work. But I definitely feel like I'm in my own corner, sort of like I was just saying about some of those critics, I feel like I've really established for myself what my own corner and my own parameters and my own intentions for my work are.
Yeah, and that must be really give you a lot of confidence, a lot of, you know, self-assurance, I think, when you know what it is you stand for with your art, so that when those criticisms do come, you're able to field them better, I would assume.
Yeah, that's so true. That's a great point.
Did you ever struggle with that, with figuring out what you wanted to say? And if so, what did you, how did you fight your way through that, or paint your way through that maybe?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is trial and error. I think that a lot of figuring out what it is that you want in your work, or what I want in my work, is trying things and then recognizing when they're leading in a direction I want to go, or when I've sort of found the outer edges. I always told my students, like, see if you can find the outer boundaries of what kind of work you can make. I think a lot of times there's pressure to immediately sort of have work that's cohesive, and rather than work that way where you're constricting yourself, because that I think creates a lot of times like a block. It's really good to see how far you can make work that still feels like it's your own, and then you've sort of established some boundaries, and then within that start to hone in what it is. Yeah. Thank you.
Now, when you were saying that, I'm just imagining you've got like this literal, like a Venn diagram, like the circle of what it art is. And it's true. When you were saying that, I was just imagining, just from seeing so much work and seeing how so many different artists work, that there is that tendency to make the circle smaller in an attempt to, oddly, it seems like it's sort of that attempt that you were speaking about earlier, about taking things out and simplifying your work. And the vision is that that would make the circle smaller and smaller, but it's actually the way you're really doing it, the circle's getting bigger and bigger.
Well, I think, yeah, you don't want to maybe prematurely, you know, sort of try to make it cohesive when it doesn't really feel like you know that thing that you're after, because then you get bored and you feel like you're repeating yourself. But if you can see as far as you can go, you, at least I can't make work beyond what feels like there's an interest in making it. So then I can know how, just how far out the work can be. And then eventually it's going to probably swell out and come back down, you know.
For people who haven't seen your work, how would you describe it?
Oh, that's a hard one, isn't it? When someone asks you that at like an opening or something.
I know, it's terrible. I thought I'd wait a little bit.
Yeah, I think, well, I work primarily figuratively and some still life. And the work is usually sort of intimate, you know, things that are in my world, scenes of people in positions a lot of time, drivers and eaters and bathers, those kinds of things in these private moments. You know, food and flowers and mirrors are subjects I often visit. But I think a lot of my work, like my process and my questions in the studio, aren't so much about the subject as formal questions. A lot of my work's driven by questions of color, space, shape, and sort of distorting some of those things. So maybe it comes off as these intimate, quiet scenes, but underneath there's maybe something a little bit bizarre about the composition or the color harmony or something like that.
What is it that grabs your attention that makes you choose a particular subject or motif?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know exactly. I have in my sketchbook on the first page always a list of ongoing just ideas, which can be really vague, like grocery stores in it right now, or it can be very specific. Like I just saw this group of grapes and some of them were off in the little stems, and I wrote that down as an idea. And I don't know that that's always going to be, you know, I'm not going to just start a painting of that or of the grocery store, but I just sort of like have these images to pull from a little bit. And I don't know what grabs my eye for them besides just some sense of a fresh, you know, I've seen the thing that I'm always seeing in a new way somehow. It can be color a lot of times. It can be pattern or a kind of mood. I'm not sure. There isn't really one thing. And I try not to describe it to myself too much or define it so that it's that stays open.
Interesting. What role does your sketchbook play in your work? I'd love to hear like kind of talk about that.
You know what? It goes in and out. It's not always playing the same role for me. If I'm making a lot of work or I'm at the point where I've just wrapped something up and I need to, I feel like my practice in general is pretty cyclical. Hopefully it lines up with a show, but I'll go through a point where I get to like an ending point. Hopefully it's a show or a body of works produced. And then it's not that I'm starting fresh, but I've sort of like reflected a bit and it's time to make up some new parameters and challenges. So that's when the sketchbook plays a big role, which is sort of right now. And I'll do some drawings from life. I'll do a lot of going to shows and like making drawings or just taking notes. And a lot of times also for me, surprisingly, I do a lot of quick drawings, but a lot of times it's actually writing things, little notes, but notes about color or about ideas rather than a full on drawing, because I like a lot of that trial and error to happen.
Is that, sometimes I feel like I'm asking questions that are just so specific, but I don't know why it makes me so curious.
Yeah, no, please. That's a real strength of, I love your podcast. It's a real strength, I think, you know.
Thank you. So are these notes that you're taking, are they fragments? Or are you writing full on descriptions? Or is it just like if it's a photograph, it's like there's a snapshot or you're filming something and really getting everything, you know?
No, they're definitely fragments of thought. One, I'm open to a page right now and it says egg, bush, flat red, pink next to red. Reframing radical. So these are like notes that trigger things that I've thought about a little bit more broadly. Like they're kind of shorthand to myself. My husband sometimes picks it up and is like, what are you talking about here? Usually I remember what I'm trying to tell myself.
I love that. It's almost like this random poetry.
Yeah, I don't know.
Can you describe your process? What is it like when you go from that sketchbook into your studio? And
I try to work on a lot of things at once. That was something that really opened things up for me. It took me a while to get to the point where I was doing that consistently. But for the last, 8 years, probably, I've always worked on a bunch of things at once because it takes off some of the pressure and it also allows me to work longer. You know, if one painting's going badly, okay, just put it away and grab another one. So I always have a lot of things going and they can start differently. Sometimes I have a very clear idea. So I'm looking around right now and one of my paintings is a pretty straightforward from life portrait. And, you know, that's just me sitting at my easel and turning to the mirror and looking, and then I'll sort of move away from that and work on it, not as much from life. And then others will start just with a color field, like, you know, maybe it was a failed painting, or I just was thinking about a color, put that down and start with less of an idea and almost let the subject bubble up a little bit. So I try to keep that kind of spectrum for myself in the work too. I used to work always sort of from life or from memory of imagery towards, it would sort of abstract from there. And then I started to allow some of the paintings to go the opposite way, where maybe it started more abstractly with color and worked toward an image. And I try to let them land. They usually land somewhere sort of with both things present. Like I said, I'm really interested when a subject that's nameable, image-based, and the paint and the color and the painting questions sort of are equally present, but sometimes one is a little bit stronger than the other.
Mm-hmm. I can definitely see that in your work. Your work has this sort of like a very introspective part to it, but then there's also so much mystery in it, both looking at it as, because human beings, we tend to do this. We automatically look for the recognizable thing, whether that's an image or a story that we're telling ourselves. But there's also a lot of mystery in it. Can you talk a little bit about that, about sort of honing in on the mysteries of paintings? And are there times when you're sort of following your intuition and then later discover something about your own work that you didn't know?
I think that's a great a great way to put it. I think a lot of the work is intuitive. Oh, you know, and questions of form, like, oh, the, you know, when I start, oh, there needs to be more depth in this area, or, you know, there's too similar a value here. And so, I start with a lot of those kind of questions, but I definitely look for those surprises in the process that come up that you could have never sort of planned. You know, even if I, like I said, start with a straightforward idea, a lot of times the painting, you know, there's just something the painting wants to do. And so the longer I'm painting, the more I'm trusting and following that and seeing where that might go. And a lot of times it doesn't work. And hopefully sometimes it does. But those kind of surprises in what can happen in terms of, like, you know, spatially or color relationships, and they can add to that mood. I think about those formal things in relation to creating that nuance and subtlety in mood and feeling.
I don't know if you can describe this, but you know, when you kind of transition from the analytical part of painting, the questions of form, the questions of drawing, is this the right proportion, et cetera, et cetera. And then you kind of move into this other state where, I don't know how it is for you, but to me, it's just like you get into that flow state, or your intuition takes over. It's a deeper level of yourself. Can you describe how that is for you?
Isn't it?
Yes.
So good. I think that's what it's all about. You know, it's like for me, I'm just slogging through, waiting to hopefully have that happen. And the worst days are when it's like the whole time you're just trying something new. It doesn't work, you know, and you never get into that sweet spot where you're so, you know, totally present. And that's the time that you just, the time just passes and you're just in it. And, you know, it feels like everything that you do is this great thing. And then you go to the bathroom, you come back, you're like, oh, it wasn't that great. But
like, what?
Right? Oh, God. Yeah, that's what we live for.
I used to blame that on the fumes. I'd be like, oh, man.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. I go get some fresh air. It's like, okay, everything's about how it was.
Yeah, those are the moments that I think we live for. You're right, as painters.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, though, maybe you don't leave and come back in, but it feels like you just sort of wake up in a way, like you're in that state. And then all of a sudden you're like, right. Wait a second, I'm kind of conscious now. What's this on my canvas and how did it get there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, or the phone rings or something.
Something snaps you out of it.
Breaks the spell, yeah.
Could you describe a typical day for you? I'm wondering if you have any, like, sort of habits or routines or things that you do when you get in your studio.
Let's see. I always work by the daylight. I have a young son, so that would be the only option probably, because my studio is not in my house. But I've always liked working by daylight. So usually it's sort of like the typical hours, you know, 9 to 5 or something, you know, in that range. And I come in and a lot of times see what I did at the last minute, the last time I was here. That's, you know, a lot of times that last bit of the day before got kind of sloppy or I didn't know what to do. And so a lot of times I'll just quickly try to address, you know, I think in the morning you have such a freshness or like a boldness or clarity. So, you know, sometimes I'll get right into those things. And then after, I don't know, an hour or something, I have a little ledge where I put paintings up that are in progress and I'll usually sit back and look at them and think about if I need to pull any new things out to work on, or I try to give myself some space so that I don't get into any kind of autopilot. You know, it's different, I guess. There's like that sweet spot we were just talking about, but then there's that autopilot where you're just kind of filling things in. I never want to get into that place where the decisions aren't really conscious. So I don't know. I try to take breaks. And so usually the day sort of goes like that, where I'll just go in between like these work sessions where I'm pulling different paintings up, working on one for as long as I can, then the next one, and then I'll, you know, physically like step back or have lunch or coffee, something like that.
How do you know, or do you know, the difference from that feeling of just going with your intuition, that sweet spot that we were talking before, versus you're filling in between the lines and doing things by rote?
I think it's a feeling. I think the autopilot is where there aren't those exciting things that happen. There aren't those, ooh, look at that. What if I do that? There isn't that engagement of sort of risk. There's sort of just things get too routine. The brush stroke gets too similar or something. And then I know it's time to either like make a big move, like scrape. I do a lot of scraping. So I'll scrape everything back or, you know, put down a big shape or something, or I'll just step away if I feel like everything's too tentative and I can't think of a big move that is going to be, I'm not making that move. Then I'll just step back or turn the paintings, flip them backwards or something.
How do you start your paintings? What's your process for that?
They're all different. You know, there's only a few ways, I guess, but they, like I said, some are really, the idea is really specific. They're in the sketchbook. I want to start that idea that I wrote down, and that's how I start. And the rare thing is when it goes, that starting point is the thing that works, and I finish the painting, and it's what I imagined. I think a lot of times when you begin as a painter, you think like that's how it should work, and that's a source of frustration. But I rarely trust that anymore to make something, like to have the idea and carry it through and it work. That's just, I don't know, that's dangerous. So most of the time I'll either start there and the painting won't work, or I'll, you know, see something that I like better that's happening and move toward that. Or, you know, if I don't have a clear idea, I'll just, like I said, put down a color that I've been thinking about, or put down, you know, a couple different things, just some big marks to get composition going, or, you know, something to respond to. I think those are the ways I'll begin usually.
Do you ever, while you're painting, just completely decide that, okay, I had that initial spark, an idea to start this, and you're halfway through and realize that is not going to work at all, and just completely, completely change it?
Yeah. So many times. And sometimes I'm very hesitant to let it go, but I've gotten better at that, where it's just, this was a dud and I'll just scrape it away. But it got me into the painting. And that, I think, is so important to always feel like you have the next thing to do, or you have an old painting to paint on top of.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
It's scary to do that. I think a lot of, maybe it's that idea of, it's like the cost.
Yeah.
It's not the cost fallacy. Anyway, it's the idea that you've already put that much time into it, or if it's a financial thing, I've already put that much money into it. So instead of stopping, I'm just going to throw more at it because.
I know. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'll spend a lot of time, like, you know, working around the little part that I like, or, you know, making small moves, but eventually I just recognize, okay, this is not happening. And then it's got to be a big move. But, you know, it might not happen in that one day. I might not be brave enough to do that for a few days, few weeks. And then a lot of times I'll pull out an old painting and just say, like, you know, what were you attached to about this? This is horrible. and rework.
Oh God, it's so zen, right? Or so there's so much like meditation in this of like, what are you attached to? You need to let that go.
Right.
Live your life.
Right. Oh, it's a battle. It is.
Totally.
You know, people are always like, oh, you know, being a painter, it must be so nice. You see people in the park painting. And I'm always, you know, I tell students, it's like, those people are in the battle for their lives. Like, it is like, you know, like this life and death thing happening for them. And you think, oh, walking by, oh, it must be so nice to stand out and nature. It's like, no, it's so hard.
What are some of the lessons that you've learned from your failed paintings?
I feel almost like I've just sort of started to allow that to be something that I churn. You know, I don't even think of it in that way anymore, where I failed. It's like the whole studio practice is this ongoing larger battle, you know, this larger thing where, you know, one painting that doesn't work. And I think that has a lot to do with, like I said, with working on multiple things at once. So there's less pressure on that one. But, you know, I just kind of like churn it back into the pile of things to work on top of. And a lot of that's become a big part of my final image, to have the history of the paintings below, you know, allow for textures to bubble up on the surface that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So I think I have a lot of faith now that I didn't have before, that it's not necessarily a failed painting. It's just like the start of the next one.
I love that.
It doesn't always feel that, you know, good when when I'm actually in it, but I do feel like it's going to be okay. Just, you know, I get to come in the next day and try again.
Yeah.
It's reassuring.
Very. And it's easy to get to that place where it's exhausting and frustrating when you're only looking at that one painting rather than, as you said, that it's this ongoing process, that this is, there's not one painting. It's the body of work that you're going to make from today to, you know, the next 40, 50, 60 years, however long, like we can still hold brushes in our hands.
Exactly. That's the goal, isn't it?
That's right. Who said that? I want to die with a paintbrush in my hand.
Mm-hmm. I just read Gustin's daughter's memoir, and she said they buried him with cadmium red and Mars black, I think. And I thought, oh, that's nice. You know, like I didn't even think about that.
So good. Oh my God, that's fantastic. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Even beyond this life.
Exactly. What are you working on now? What is it that you're currently obsessed with?
I've had such a busy year. I'm really coming up for air. I had a show in September and a show in March, like a mini show in March. And then I've been teaching this year and my son just turned one. So it was like completely depleting in every way. I mean, it was amazing.
That is a big year.
It was very depleting. So right now, I'm so happy for it to be summer and my semester just finished. So I'm sort of like, I'm recharging, I'm looking at things, and I'm sort of trying to launch into a new body of work. Like I was just saying about that cycle, I feel like I'm sort of at the beginning now, and that's exciting.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know exactly what in terms of subject or where the work is going to go. I got a bunch of flowers in the studio right now and a bunch of ideas. And so things are just kind of percolating.
Oh, that's a fun place to be.
Yeah, I think hopefully it'll be good. It's summer.
It will. I have faith in you, Aubrey. What do you do to replenish yourself?
I think always that almost nourishing my eyeballs. I like think of it as this visual thing where you like feed your eyes, you know? So to go to the museum and the galleries and to look at my books and to make drawings from some of those things, to go out in the world, just walk around and see what might grab my attention. I think that's so important. A lot of times, you know, earlier on, I would feel like, you know, like I was just procrastinating, but I actually think that's really integral to making good work, to feel like I've seen things that make me want to go back and make my own work and like set that bar. You know, when you get that feeling after going to a show, just like, wow, I need to get back in my studio. Like I've got so many ideas. I think that's really worthwhile. And I try to be patient with myself and allow for that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's so critical to give yourself moments of rest. I think we're kind of naturally driven to just keep going and going. And like you alluded to with, you know, how people think of artists, that it's always this beautiful, fun thing and that, you know, they don't see the we are in there sort of fighting for our lives. Right. But we know that. And yet we tend to think that that vision of being an artist is the correct one, that that's the way it should be. And so when it's not, there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of problems with this romantic painter myth, you know, that, I mean, it can either be this like lunatic in the studio just going nuts and constantly creating at 3 a.m. or it can be this like bucolic, you know, scene and everything's nice. And, you know, I think all of us live in the world where we have those moments, you know, of being either of those things. But a lot of times it's just kind of somewhere in the middle. You're kind of,
yeah,
trying to, you know, find, and I think it's really important to just recognize that when I personally need a moment to go to the museum, allowing for it, or when I need to just keep putting a few strokes down on the panels and not put too much pressure. It's hard to do that. It's really hard. It's a struggle. I always have, but you know, I'm saying it out loud so that I believe it. You know, we have to find a balance.
Yeah. I have this problem where I will think that, like, in my head, okay, I'm just going to do this one more thing. I'm just going to finish this painting, or I'm just going to lay in that canvas. And then I'm going to take a break. So I'll work all day today. And then tomorrow I'll go out and play. Right. And yeah. Then tomorrow I'm like, no way.
Right.
So it's like, I have to actually force myself to take a break. It's ridiculous. It really is. And I kind of like, I'm embarrassed to say it sometimes, because it's just like, especially like I live in Mammoth, which is a ski resort. It's people come here to go on vacation, and I have to force myself to go out and enjoy where I live. And they're like, what is wrong with you? You're a sick person.
But that's the beauty of it, because it, while it's so hard, it's also so good. It's such fun, mm-hmm. a fun struggle, that it's really feels so good to be in the studio, even if it's not going well.
Yeah. You also reminded me. So I have a friend of mine who's a pilot, and for some reason he's started discovering stock photography of pilots, and he just keeps posting them on his social media stream, and just completely ridiculing them, because the photos are just so, it's like somebody else's ridiculous idea of what it's like, yes. to be a pilot. And so then I went and I looked for stock photography on artists.
Oh my, that must be bad.
It is the worst you've ever seen. It's either literally some
a beret
with a striped shirt and the twisted dully mustache.
Yes.
Or if it's a female artist, like apparently the view of female artists is that we can't figure out the difference between a canvas and our bodies. And so like, they have paint all over them. Oh, where do you guys get these ideas on what it is to be an artist?
Yeah, right.
And it just goes downhill from there. Like, there's women like in a bikini painting. There's like, it's just, I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, yeah, that's why we have the reputation that we have, I guess, is that there's this like thing that we're either totally insane.
I know. It's funny, because I just went to a new doctor, and you know, they have the form where you put like your occupation, and I actually wanted to leave it blank. I got to the other side of the paper and I was like, I guess I need to write that I'm a painter, but I hate that conversation anymore, where you talk about with someone else who doesn't maybe know, like, you know, that conversation, oh, it must be so hard financially. I mean, it's just, or, oh, you know, it must be so nice. And it's just, it's so loaded. It's like, I don't even want to tell anyone, because it's realizing what it is to be a painter. It's tough. I don't know.
It is. It absolutely is. I was just talking about this today with some of my students, this idea that like, I sort of have gotten to the point where I just have a number of answers ready in my pocket, kind of based on how I'm perceiving that person's knowledge of the art world is. So like, if I'm talking to you, I will give a really in-depth, complete answer, right? Because I know you're actually interested, or I'm going to assume you're actually interested, and that you're asking because you want to know the answer. And then there's other people that it's the briefest answer, and no, I don't do tattoos.
Right.
And I'm sure your cousin's grandmother is an exceptional artist.
Yes. <exactly.
laughs> And no, I'm not starving. Thank you.
Right. I know. I was thinking that, oh man, it's like, when do you ask the doctor, like, oh, you must be spending your money so freely, you know? It's like,
I know. That's so true. I think I've just gotten to the point where I kind of look at it. It's like, okay, they don't know any better. They're not malicious. They're not, there's good intent. So I kind of look at it like, okay, I'm going to give them as much information as they can take, even if it's just a little bit.
Yeah.
So that the next time they come across an artist, because I think what they're trying to do, even if it's awkward, like, I'm sure I've started many awkward conversations not knowing how to talk to somebody or what to say.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I do, you know. Like, right. Dentist, you're like, oh, do you want to look at my tooth? You know,
right.
It's across any discipline, I'm sure. But
they have their equivalent of it. So I kind of like go, okay, this is my chance to give them something so that the next time they run into an artist, they have something that they can build off of. And then hopefully that artist will continue it. So that it took me a while to get there. I used to be like,
no, that's the right way to be.
Sorry, we just had a little segue there. I'm kind of curious for if you have a painting that you talked about, that drawing that you did when you were younger of yourself as an artist and your magic hats. But do you have a painting that you've done that you would never give or sell or otherwise let out of your possession?
I think that painting I actually sold. So I regret one of them, which was sort of like the first painting I really felt like I was looking at myself reformed in paint. Like it just felt like this is the first time I made a painting that I didn't think was good. But beyond that, I thought it was like mine, which was a painting in graduate school of myself and my husband sitting at a table. And I think at that point, it was really important actually to get the recognition that work was good and that it would sell. So I don't know, that meant a lot to me then. But now I think, oh, like, I want to know where that is and go get it back. So yeah, maybe someday.
That's frustrating. But it's kind of bittersweet in a way, because it is, you know, it was an important painting for you. And also the significance of somebody saying, yeah, I agree with you, that's an important painting. And I want that.
Yeah. And I'll say too, I mean, I think that, but then if I ever hang my work in our house, I can't have it there for more than a few months until I'd want to take it back into the studio, either like turn it around or do something to it. So I think if I even got that one back, it wouldn't live somewhere that I was looking at it. So it's probably better to be out in the world.
If you could own a painting by any living artist, what would it be or whose?
Wow, that's a hard one. There are so many good painters in Philly that I think I would choose someone here. I don't know. Like, I love Rebecca Callahan's work, Adam Lovitz, Mario Capanna, my friend Polina Barskaya. She's actually up in New York, but I think I need to invest in some friends' work because I'm always so happy to see their shows.
That's a great answer. You've probably heard me say this before, but the reason I ask that is because I usually hear about artists that I don't know of. And that's why I make sure it's living and not dead artists. Because I'm like, okay, who's out there working that I don't know about that I should? Or actually, maybe that's a better question to ask is who do you think people should be paying attention to right now? Or who do you think is sort of underrated?
I love work that is quiet. And I think that kind of work a lot of times just doesn't get attention because it's quiet. So people like those that I mentioned, I love the work of Angela Acourt. I love the work of Jennifer Packer. I mean, these are people who have attention, but I think their work is so beautiful. Dustin Metz, Samantha Mitchell. I'm sure I'm forgetting people off the top of my head, but they're just, I don't know. I think if I could, you know, shift things, I would love to see more attention to work that takes time and is subtle and is seen in person is really like a rich experience.
Mm-hmm. I don't know most of those artists that you mentioned, which to me is super exciting. So now I get to dive down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Last question, if you could give yourself the artist that you were, let's say 10 years ago. So where are we now? We're 2018. So in 2008, if you could give that artist, that person you were, a piece of advice, what would it be?
Yeah. My advice would be the answers are in the paint, because that was right after undergraduate for me. And at that point, I always felt like I had to have an idea to go forward, or I had to know a lot or something to make a painting. And I think that creates blocks. So now when I feel that, I either go, like I said, and feed my eyes, or I just go into the studio and paint. You know, I just slog through and put marks down. So I think that is the way forward always. And I think I would have avoided a lot of frustration if I just fully allowed for that kind of play and experimentation and failure at that point.
I think we all would. I love it. Aubrey, thank you so much. That was such a delightful conversation. I really enjoyed getting to know you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Thanks so much to Aubrey Leventhal for sharing her insights. If you're in New York, you can see her work at the Nancy Margolis Gallery in Chelsea. Go to savvypainter.com and click on the podcast tab. You'll find show notes there, along with examples of Aubrey's work, with links to all of the artists that we talked about. And while you're there, make sure you don't miss an episode of the podcast. Sign up for show updates and free guides at savvypainter.com. The Savvy Painter podcast is made possible in large part by artists just like you. If you would like to help out, it's quick, it's easy, and I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. Just go to savvypainter.com/support. If this podcast has made a difference in your studio, if it gives you a little bit of company while you are painting, please consider making a donation. Any amount helps. And with that, I would like to give a shout out and a big, big thank you to Renat Gorin, Psychodynamic Yoga, Lois McCarthy, Robert Doucette, Denise Presnell, Cherie Seinkowitz. Cherie, I really hope I said your last name right. Vivian Larkins, Diane Foster, Julie Riley, Leanne Harrison, Nicola Pixworth, Diane McGee, Robert Talbert, Judith Chapman, Susan Rose, Helen O'Connor, Julie Marr, J.A. Moore, Marilyn Creary, Teresa Hill, Vincent Keeling, Brian Buckrell, Alchemy Works, Denise Klitzy, Deb Cook Shapiro, Gleary Fine Art, Lucinda Kasser, Pat Oxley, Jill Opelka, Susan Zefton Kuhn, Kathleen Speranza, ZB Gallery, and David Gorski. Thank you so, so much for your support of The Savvy Painter. So until the next time, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter podcast. Thank you so much for listening.